Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving in not-so-sunny California.
And I'm Ken Rudin in Washington, D.C. And Ron, while you're in Schwarzenegger land, we are still in Washington listening to the reactions, the mostly positive reactions, to Barack Obama's speech to a joint session of Congress earlier this week.
We will rebuild, we will recover, and the United States of America will emerge stronger than before.
An astonishingly positive reaction, even in the hall, from Republicans, by and large. Of course, they didn't show the same enthusiasm the Democrats did. But it was a far cry from what we've seen in terms of their united opposition to the stimulus package and so on. They seemed much friendlier to the president this week. Why would you think that would happen?
Well, I was going to say part of it may be the polls. I mean, polls show that there is a public resistance to the Republican resistance to the stimulus package. Only three Republicans in the Senate voted for it, none in the House. And if you look at the polls, they say, look, the crisis is severe. The situation is pretty scary, but let's go along with the president. We're with him, and we think that what the Republicans are doing are playing politics, at least according to the polls, and that's not working. So perhaps one of the reasons so many of them got up during the president's speech on Tuesday night was, one, maybe they want it to work, and I assume they do want it to work.
They want to see the economy come back and, you know, unemployment not to go much higher, all that sort of stuff. Surely they're on board for that.
And I think also the fact is that they still intend to pick and choose their battles, and there will be battles to come. You know, the untold amounts are being spent on health care, what President Obama wants to do for energy, and of course decisions to be made about Iraq and Afghanistan. Those are to come, but at least on Tuesday night, it seemed like a one big happy family, at least for them.
There's going to be so many opportunities for them to show this unity that they're so proud of in terms of their opposition. Really, they didn't need to be any more resistant in this particular moment. At the same time, before the week was out, we were seeing details, or at least few details, of the president's program, an outline of his first budget. I don't think the Republicans are going to have any trouble maintaining that unity.
Well, they seem to have trouble, at least in the polls, in responding to the president. And I'm referring to Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, who was the responder to President Obama's address to the Congress.
The strength of America is not found in our government. Is found in the compassionate hearts and the enterprising spirit of our citizens.
And he did not get the kind of reviews that the president got.
Well, and he did not even get the kind of reviews that Bobby Jindal should have gotten. This guy is very sharp. He is enormously well prepared. He makes a good delivery most of the time.
And not Tuesday night.
Tuesday night, the problem, I thought, was staging. I understood that they wanted to be in Baton Rouge and not in Washington, even though Governor Jindal had been in Washington not but hours before for the National Governors Association meeting. He wanted to have it out in the country to be speaking back to Washington, and that's all understandable. But there was a quality about it that seemed oddly detached from the president's own presentation and from what was going on in the Capitol. It didn't really seem to have the gravity or the weight that was the feature of the president's presentation, and it just sounded stagey.
It did, and which is surprising because Bobby Jindal from the beginning was being sold as the bright new shining star for the Republican Party, one of the more principled leaders. Obviously, he may be a wonk, but he's very smart, and of course, believe it or not, they're talking about 2012 already, which is amazing.
Well, but he has a great common touch. He's not just a wonk. He's not just a brilliant guy. And in fairness to him, this response to the president thing is a difficult thing. And it's very hard to think of one back over the last 20, 30 years that they've been doing it that really sticks in the mind, with the possible exception of February 1985, right after Ronald Reagan's 49-state landslide reelection. A then-obscure Southern governor sat on a stool and gave the Democratic response to Ronald Reagan's State of the Union. Who was that governor, Ken?
That was actually the governor of Arkansas, and of course that was Winthrop Rockefeller. No, that was Bill Clinton.
Yes, it was. And that was the first time most people in the country ever heard of Bill Clinton, let alone saw him.
And then
he did a pretty good job.
And
it was a very apologetic job. It was like, we Democrats get the message, you don't like us, and began that sort of Bill Clinton triangulation personality that we saw so much of in the 1990s.
But here's the reason why choosing Bobby Jindal to give the Republican response made the most sense. First of all, he had a principled, you could agree or disagree, but he had a principled argument against the stimulus package. And so unlike Governor Schwarzenegger in California, Governor Crist in Florida, who welcomed the money, desperately needed the money, his opposition, Mark Sanford in South Carolina, Haley Barber, Mississippi, Rick Perry of Texas, those Republican governors' opposition to accepting the stimulus money or part of the stimulus money was based, according to what they say, on principle. So there was a philosophical reason why Bobby Jindal was the right person. And yet, as you say, the tone of Jindal's remark was almost, I mean, it certainly paled in comparison. Barack Obama, of course, is a very good speaker, and he's gotten much better throughout the campaign. But when you listen to the enormity of the problems that Obama spelled out in his address, and then have to see an almost like an aw shucks Bobby Jindal coming on, well, like President Obama, I have a good personal story too, but it almost seemed too aw shucksy and not somebody who was representing the Republican Party, or at least the opposition, what's left of it, to Barack Obama.
So bottom line, not a great start for Bobby Jindal on the national stage, but at the same time, we still expect him to be very much in the hunt as the Republicans look for new leaders and new spokespeople in the years to come.
Right, and we don't have to say 2012. We just look, you know, we have Michael Steele as the new Republican national chairman, and we'll see him a lot, but if you look to the Congress, Mitch McConnell and John Boehner are not going to be the principal go-to guys, I suspect, if Republicans are looking for a new kind of voice. And Bobby Jindal supposedly was going to fill that role. He still may. And of course, you know, there are other Republicans out there. And a matter of fact, CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, gets together. They're meeting this week in Washington. And you'll see a lot of conservative leaders coming out. Paul Ryan, the congressman from Wisconsin, is considered to be one of the rising stars.
I'm a big Paul Ryan fan. I think he's really got the right stuff. You know, I really do. I mean, among conservatives in the Congress today, he's about as bright a light as you're going to find.
And I suspect that it's much easier for conservatives now, rather than defend an unpopular president and try to convince fellow conservatives that, yes, George W. Bush is really one of us, I think, as it was when Bill Clinton was president, when Jimmy Carter was president, it's easier to be a conservative because it's easier, as Newt Gingrich showed, that it was just easier to throw bombs from the outside than to govern from the inside. And I think this may not be as bad a time for conservatives as some on the right might think.
You know, speaking of Democrats being in charge of everything, particularly on Capitol Hill, they now have the votes, it appears, in both the Senate and the House to pass a bill giving full voting rights in the House to the District of Columbia and the disenfranchised roughly 600,000 residents of the capital city. Now, this is not a done deal. The president will obviously sign it, but it then has to go into the courts. And there is a very good question as to whether or not it can survive a court test. But Ken, is this not a somewhat overdue adjustment to allow the people who live in the capital city to actually have a representative in Congress?
There is no question that the residents of the District of Columbia who pay a high amount of taxes are not represented in Congress. Eleanor Holmes Norton, who was first elected in 1990, the delegate from D.C., she can vote in committee, but she cannot vote on the floor. The license plates in Washington, D.C. talk about taxation without representation, and that's absolutely true. It's a guaranteed passage in the House. But here's the question. The question is whether it is constitutional. And Robert Byrd, the senior senator from West Virginia, who every time you talk about the Constitution, when you talk about Iraq and things like that, well, Robert Byrd is right because he's the constitutional expert. But he also says that this may not be a constitutional way of giving D.C. voting rights. I mean, first of all, right now, the way it looks like, we'll give D.C. a voting member in Congress, and then we'll add a district in Utah, and that'll be some kind of a deal.
In fairness, by the way, Utah is entitled to another representative in Congress.
And that's why they have, every 10 years, they have a census.
A census.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, Utah can get another seat in 2012. What I'm saying is I think that proponents of D.C. vote are premature in declaring victory. Yes, it's good news for them. It's the best news they've had, I guess, in 30 years. I mean, I don't think the Senate has looked at that since 1978. But there are still constitutional problems, and the courts will ultimately rule whether this is the way to do it.
That's right, because the Constitution is written with the presumption that the capital city will be a very small place in which there is not a very large population of people living outside of a state and being therefore disenfranchised. Of course, the Constitution was written a few years ago, and we now have a major city that's grown up around the capital, and the people who live there can't vote. Now, in full disclosure, I'm one of those people. Ken is not, because Ken is what we call a suburbanite. Not to make this an emotional argument, but, Ken, what would you do to address the unfairness here? Would you vote for a constitutional amendment to allow D.C. to vote?
Ron Elving, I ask you, what is the problem with Washington, D.C. being usurped into the state of Maryland? First of all, they would probably control the state more than Baltimore does because they would have the biggest voting population.
Which is precisely why Maryland feels as though that would be taking away their individuality as a state and taking over their political system. And why should they be penalized so that enfranchisement can come after, lo, these centuries to the oppressed trust people of the District of Columbia.
There are other solutions, I guess, as Tom Coburn of Oklahoma suggested, perhaps ending all federal taxes on members of District of Columbia. So, you know, if the question is whether we pay taxes, why can't we vote? How about if Washington, D.C. could do neither? They'll neither pay taxes nor vote.
You might get a few votes for that. I think that that would probably not be a fair solution. But it might have more appeal than just outright disenfranchisement.
What about just have nobody pay taxes and then everybody can join the Obama cabinet?
Speaking of the Obama cabinet, I think we're finally getting a full cabinet fleshed out. We've got Gary Locke, the former governor of Washington State.
First, the only Chinese-American ever elected governor.
That is correct.
Can I just tell you why I mentioned that? Because it was a very interesting sight on Tuesday night during the president's address when you have the first African-American president. Behind him was sitting the first Roman Catholic vice president in history, the first female Speaker of the House in history. The Republican response was given by the first Indian-American governor in history. And then the next day, the president names the first Chinese-American governor in history to his cabinet. And I thought there was a lot of firsts there.
Interesting, and you are making an excellent point.
And also, of course, it's not complete. We do have Hilda Solis confirmed as Secretary of Labor, but we still don't have an HHS secretary.
And, of course, there have been a lot of rumors that it's going to be Kathleen Sebelius, the governor of Kansas. A lot of people want her to run for the Senate from that state to give Democrats a chance at their first Kansas Senate seat since the 1930s. But she may be drafted into this cabinet as well, and that would finally complete the full cabinet members. But right now there are an awful lot of undersecretaries, deputy undersecretaries, and so on, who haven't been named yet because the top jobs haven't been filled. So it's starting to be an embarrassment to the Obama administration that they are not fully staffed.
There may be another opening, and that could be a senator from Illinois. What are you hearing about that?
Well, Roland Burris has been pushed to the brink of resignation. If there is such a thing as resignation in shame, he...
Two words, Rod Blagojevich. I suspect
right.
not.
We have said for some days now that if he has any shame, Roland Burris is going to have to resign.
And he said that if I were guilty of that, I would have the understanding that I would resign. I'm not that shameless that I would stay in office, which is so amazing.
Yes, he says that, but then he stays in office, which tends to indicate the opposite.
Here's the thing. When they voted on the stimulus package, they held the vote open for 5 hours so Sherrod Brown could get back from the funeral of his mother so he can vote. Obviously, they're not going to force out a senator anytime soon, given the fragile condition of Senator Ted Kennedy's health. They still don't have another senator in Minnesota, and of course, the Roland Burris situation. So I suspect that, at least for the time being, there's not going to be a major push to get him out. Look, Dick Durbin the other day had a face-to-face meeting with Burris and said, look, if I were in your shoes, you know, I would consider resigning. And Burris said, thank you, but I'm not resigning. And I don't know what else they can do. The Senate Ethics Committee is opening an investigation. There may be another investigation coming out in Springfield. But Roland Burris does not sound like somebody who's about to step away anytime soon.
This does not reflect honorably on the Democratic majority in the Senate. Obviously, they do have the Ted Kennedy situation. They do have the Minnesota problem. And in their, you know, lust for 60 votes, they really are loath to give up one from Illinois. And if Roland Burris does do what virtually everyone has urged him to do and resign, that would give them a real hole. They're not going to get another appointed senator from there because the now serving acting governor, whatever you want to call him, formerly Lieutenant Governor Pat Quinn, has said he's not going to appoint somebody to this seat after all the trouble there's been over this appointment. He wants them to have a special election. So that involves time, it involves delay, it involves another campaign, and it may involve a Republican winning the seat.
Well, actually, Pat Quinn did say that in the interim, he would name a very temporary appointment that would serve only until the special election. But you're absolutely right. Mark Kirk, the congressman from, I guess, the northern Chicago suburbs, moderate Republican, given what's happened to the Democratic Party in Illinois in the past couple of months, it's only been since basically December, and yet it seems like it's going on forever. It's just a really true embarrassment, and the Republicans could certainly pick up that seat.
Gaffe of the week, Ken?
Oh, absolutely. Last weekend, Jim Bunning, in a President's Day address, the Louisville Courier-Journal reported that, well, look, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we're probably going to have an opportunity for another Supreme Court nominee because Ruth Bader Ginsburg probably has less than a year to live. He actually,
I think he said 9 months.
No, he said,
I think he said something like she'll be gone by the fall.
Nine months, yes. And of course, all the cameras were on Justice Ginsburg when President Obama came into the Capitol to give his speech. And of course, he had a long hug with Justice Ginsburg, who just returned to work only 2 weeks after her surgery. But Bunning did. It's the latest step in a can. And, you know, five Republican senators are already retiring. And I suspect that a lot of Republicans would love a sixth to retire. Bunning has not.
If it's Jim Bunning. Only if it's Jim Bunning.
If it's Jim Bunning, right. He is not popular with his colleagues. He barely won re-election in 2004. He has criticized Mitch McConnell and John Cornyn.
Mitch McConnell being his home state Kentucky colleague.
And there's now a rumor that the state Senate president may run for the seat, and he's talked. The rumor is that he's come to Washington and talked to National Republican Senatorial Committee staffers, and Bunning says, if they support my opponent in the primary, I will sue the NRSC. It just seems like Bunning just has more enemies, or at least as many enemies on the Republican side of the aisle as he has on the Democratic side.
It is sad to see any senator's career end in buffoonery, but he does really seem to have lost his grip. Ken, I'm glad we have saved for last the most important issue of Washington, D.C. in this particular week, and that is the changing of the guard for the White House pet.
Yes, I think we should now pause and reflect the late and lamented socks.
A moment of silence. We're going to have a moment of silence on the podcast.
For that joke or for socks?
I think we're going to need 2 moments of silence, one for that joke.
Thank you.
And a second for the passing of socks.
It's interesting. You know, President Clinton, when he left the White House, he took everything with him, all the furniture, you know, God knows what else he took. But he left socks the cat behind with Betty Curry. That's kind of sad, isn't it?
I think it is sad. And now socks no longer with us. R.I.P. socks the cat. But long live the new White House pet. Ken, tell us a little bit about the Portuguese water dog.
Okay.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elvin.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR News.